Hello, I'm John Kelly, and this is a podcast of Mystery Train. For rights reasons, the music is shorter than in the original programme. Mystery Train hits the rails Sunday to Thursday at 7 p.m. on RTE Lyric FM. You know, I could think of no better song with which to introduce my guest tonight. On Sundays on Mystery Train, we always get somebody in to pick the music. And tonight, it's Brona Gallagher. Brona, good to see you.
Thank you for that extraordinary introduction.
Had you heard that song before?
I've never heard that song. It is brilliant.
I hear it and I think of you.
You think of me?
Quentin Tarantino. And hypodermic needles and women being dragged through the mud.
Well, I like that.
We'll talk about all that in a bit.
We'll talk about all that, my good. And June Charter is just one of the coolest chicks ever. So, wow, me and June and the One Thought, I love it.
So, Brona, before we get into this music, just to establish our credentials. Now, we've known each other for a very long time.
Very long time. We're at that vintage.
Yes, and I know your family and all the rest of it. So yep. That may come up. I don't want to pretend I don't. That's the
exactly.
point of that. But it's great to have you here because apart from in these situations, I never see you anyway.
I know. Listen, but sure, there's always the bond of musical love and obsession.
And I know that that's there because I got that first, not from you because I knew your sister first.
Mm-hmm.
An obsession. A very impressive obsession with soul music in particular,
yep.
which according to your sister, kind of came from your mother.
Came from mum and her Maudette friends in Derry, growing up in the 60s, and my dad as well. But my mum, Maeve, and her friends, Rosaline Harrison, they were collectors of the 45s. And you had Radio Luxembourg, you also had Derry as a port, so you had a lot of American soldiers coming in. With the records, and obviously, you know, where there's a will, there's a way, and where there's a love, they just absolutely were obsessed with soul, especially Aretha and Booker T and the MGs and the Small Faces. So they used to collect the clothes, the Vogues, the secondhand Vogues from the officers' wives that they were American ladies to come to the hairdressers that mum used to work in. So they'd get the Vogues and then they'd copy the style. And the Jean Shrimpton and all the you know, the Oxford bags and the shoes, and they all dress made and used to knit their own gear and, you know, bust out the gear, and then they have the 45s to take with them and they take them to the dances.
The way that your sister Louise, we worked together years mm-hmm. ago, the way she used to describe your house, I used to think, no, this she's making this up, this is a fantasy. But it did sound like the house was populated by the Marvelettes or something, that there was always this singing and dancing and routines going on.
It was, which we went to see, do you remember? The Marvelettes in Mandela Hall in Belfast. It was, I mean, it was, you know, my mum and dad worked, you know, 95. Well, mum didn't really go back to work there. I was probably about 12. Do a community centre in the Bogside, Pilots Row. But up until that, my mum used to do hairdressing at home and dressmaking at home. So if she had people in the house, she wouldn't be playing music. But if she was dressmaking, she always had a wee turntable or a big... They had a radiogram that my grandmother gave them when we were growing up. So it was one of those beautiful big mahogany wood lifted, you know, the lifted up the lid, and you could put the records in the middle and the stylus, you know, to the left, and the controls, the beautiful big gold knobs and the glass panel to the right. So obviously, as you know, we thought, you know, after a while this was kind of dootsy, but the sound of it was great. It was a big mono sound. And then as the years went by, they got a wee turntable, a wee Ferguson turntable, so that was much easier to work and you weren't afraid to break that as much. But that's what my mum used to blare the music off. I mean, she was cranking it, sitting there doing her dressmaking, inventing these clothes. My mammy never really bought clothes for us. She always made them. She used to downsize my daddy's Wranglers back in the days. Judy, you know, needs must as well. She downsized my dad's Wranglers and cut the wee pockets into size so we'd all have wee jeans and rock out the wee jeans and crank the music.
Your first choice, Brona, is the Shangri-Las.
Yep, the Shangri-Las, who were one of my first memories of being transported, because that's what music still does to me. It transports me to a place, and I have a very vivid imagination, and I immediately was somewhere completely different. And obviously, avoiding the obvious hits, you know, the Leader of the Pack, Out in the Streets, which is a classic. You're somewhere else that's not your living room. And once you've seen these photographs of these girls dressed the way they were dressed, with the hair down to the side, the patent boots, the tight jeans, the jackets, and images of like Leader of the Pack with the sound of the motorbike. You know, you had no videos in those days.
There was extraordinary melodrama about the Shangri-Las in particular, completely over the top stories.
Completely over the top, little mini operas. Yeah. Like the whole Shadow Morton world, you know, he was the outsider coming into the Brill Buildings at this time, early 60s, you know, the mecca of songwriting for Spectre, Ellie Greenwich, you know, Barry, all the main men that were behind the Gael groups. And this guy, they weren't sure if he was, you know, is he kosher? Is he a good songwriter or whatever? And he went away. Basically, there was an ultimatum given to him. Go away and write a track and then we'll take you seriously. Because he was getting a wee bit too close to Ellie Greenwich, who was a genius songwriter and, you know, responsible for some of the greatest, you know, Ronette stuff and the great Darlene Love and them. And he went away and wrote Walking in the Sand and came on the next day and says, there you go, there's my song. And they basically said, okay, your book's stamped. And he brought the Shangri-Las in and recorded it.
Wow.
But this is one of the ones that just, to me, kicks off, you know, any great night, and it's right now, not a minute later.
Right now and not later, as the Shangri-Las, the first choice tonight of my guest, Brona Gallagher, who's with me in studio tonight. Brona, actress, singer, original Derry girl, actually, we should mention that. Derry's all over the place now.
Derry's all over.
You were a Derry girl before it was popular and profitable.
If you could have a hidden camera into me and my girlfriends growing up, we were the Derry girls. We were the Beastie Girls.
Yeah.
That's what we were called because we were mad about the Beastie Boys. And we basically nicknamed ourselves the Beastie Girls. I mean, we were innocent as begod. Like, we didn't have any dodgy stuff going on, but we did do, like, handshakes and kind of, you know, like you had to be in the gang kind of a stuff. But we were the Derry Girls, the Beastie Girls.
How would you describe Derry to anybody from Dublin or Cork or Kerry or anyone who's listening to this tonight who hasn't a clue what Derry's like? Because it is a unique spot.
Yes.
It's not like anywhere else in the north.
Nope.
And it's not really like anywhere else in the south either.
It's the only intact walled city in Europe, number one.
Yeah.
And it is a highly politicised place. We have a huge compassion to move on in Derry City. We also have a huge love of the arts and poetry and dance and music. And you'll find some of the greatest singers in the country.
All right, this is the tourist board.
Town.
Come on.
Yes, this is Brona Gallagher, yes. Tourist board. Yeah. No, you know, Derry, as I always feel, a very progressive place, and the thinking and the moving forward and the love of arts and the love of music. And, you know, the humour of the Derry people, it is very unique. And it's an extremely warm city. When you go to Derry, people just love the warmth there, the sense of community, because that's what's kept people together and helped people move on from the troubles.
When I started going to Derry first, the first thing I noticed was, because I was working in Belfast at the time, there was always this attitude of, you wouldn't be able to do that in Belfast. I bet you don't have that in Belfast. There was a kind of a, you know, a counterpoint or a, you know, I bet you wouldn't be able to do that in Belfast.
Exactly. Well, there was a law. It's a law unto itself. It definitely was that day. But Ochna Derry's great. I love it. I go home a lot. And we've just finished a film there that my sister Louise produced. And just the sense of community and the sense of people really just wanting to, you know, bring up the arts more, invest more in the arts emotionally, financially, and just to pull that out of what's in there, and the young people, you know, not just the young people, all the generations of people. It's huge potential, I think, there as well.
It also has a unique language of its own in ways too. Already tonight you've said to me, Dootsie, which I think is a Derry thing. I mean, I know you hear it in other places, but I first heard Dootsie from Derry people. The other one, calling people a dote, is a real Derry one.
A wee dote, aye.
But there's other more obscure ones than that. Do you know when you meet somebody from Derry on the street and, you say, and instead of saying hello, they say yes?
Yes, hi.
No, they say yes, John.
Yes, yes, John, that's a crack guy. Or it's Boggan.
Aye.
It reminds me of when we were about 15, maybe younger, me and the Beastie Girls went to Donegal on a wee school trip for biology. And we used to do this thing where you'd let on to be American. Mum will let on to be Yanks. And you'd let on to be Yanks on the beach. We met these youngflas from like somewhere in Donegal. And they're like, where are you girls from? We were like, we're from Boston. And there was a couple of the girls in the show, or the couple of girls in the gang that couldn't do the accents. We were like, shut you up, you can't do the accent, you know. But one of the girls, she was determined to do the accent. She was like, come on, we're going in for a swim. And someone said, I'm not going in there, the water's bogging. So it was like, yeah, terrible acting. But bogging's a real Derry word, I think.
And you just said also, you canny do that.
You canny, but that's Scottish.
I know, yeah, but you hear that in Derry all the time, don't you?
You canny do it, a canny.
A canny.
My father said, never say you can't, always say.
What's the other one? I'm lured.
I'm all lured.
What's that, embarrassed, isn't it?
No, lured means you're delighted.
Oh,
dear,
delighted.
I'm all lured. I think it actually comes from lurds. I really do. I've actually thought about this in my bed at night. I think to go to Lourdes, because if you went to Lourdes, obviously in France, you would have been, you know, there to visit the Blessed Virgin Mary or the Blessed, whatever, St. Bernadette, I think. I'm not sure. We're Lourdes. It's the Blessed Virgin Mary.
It's been a while, has it?
It's been a while since I went to Lourdes. Probably wouldn't be allowed in. I think you would, obviously, for very spiritual people, it was to go there and experience the Lourdes experience. So I think you're all Lourdes. So I think it must come from that. But, you know, anybody that knows differently, let me know. Because I don't know if Lourdes is in any way a connection to being, you know, happy or enamoured. I'm all Lourdes. It's a dairy thing. It's a dairy thing, John.
Artie McLean's joke was, did you hear about the dairy ghost? It said boo hi.
It would. Everybody says hi. Hey, what about you? What's up, Craig?
All right, next. The Beatles. Okay, so presumably while all this soul thing was going on, what you might call the normal pop music of the day was also big stuff in the house.
Well, it was the vinyl, wasn't it? So, I mean, we're talking about, you know, if we're talking about a train, a mystery train, and obviously I'm taking this train out of the living room, you know, up into my own bedroom, right, where I got my own 45 or my own turntable and my own 45s. So it's the Beatles imagery. It was the artwork, because a lot of the time you would have just had a 45 of the Shangri-Las, but this would have been the album artwork. So this is the first album, and they were my mum's. I think she had all the original albums as the Beatles released them. And from 63 onwards, then there was a party one time in her house that her brother had when her mum and dad went away, and all the records were stolen. Devastation in the house. Devastation, still devastation.
So but much for all that community spirit.
Exactly,
about
I know, forget about that. I don't know who this retrobate was. But the Beatles, 63, so it was the first song. It's the first song on side A of the first Beatles album, and it just completely blew my mind. And it was like you plugged the plug into your head. It was the electricity that came off the record, and it was one of those ones you would dive home from school, get the tea and the scone, and up on the bedroom, boom, plug it into the head. It couldn't be loud enough. I don't know how I'm still with hearing, because the headphones would go on, I'd be like, just crank it up. I saw her standing there, the sexiest song ever, because Lennon changed the lyric, because apparently Paul McCartney went, well, she was just 17, never been a beauty queen. And Lennon went, she was just 17, if you know what I mean. So cue the screaming. There it is.
1, 2, 3, 4.
And that's Little Richard there, the king and queen of rock and roll.
The king and queen, very much so. And what a king and queen he was.
Unbelievable. And it's still... sounds incredible, Little Richard. You can only imagine the effect of that the first time it came out. I wish I'd been there.
Absolutely. And as a front man, you know, you're thinking like, you're talking 1956, do you know what I mean? And you're seeing this guy coming out. I think for a lot of us that love music and soul music, you have to think at what cost these guys were performing at. You know, and obviously touring with some of the greatest musicians then that we knew, like Jimi Hendrix, you know, people that turn with them as young guitar players. And you just think, what must it have been like to see that coming and rolling into your town and that up on the stage? And still right to the very end, he was one of the, when him, Jerry Lee Lewis, some of the greatest showmen ever. And just to see that flamboyancy.
Well, I mean, as they say about, you know, they talk about rock and roll, but the parents were afraid of Elvis. Mm. I'd say they were pretty scared of Little Richard.
Little Richard, yeah. Tiger, easy tiger.
But as he always used to joke about it, he always said, you know, well, you know, My records would be in the house, you know. They'd be on the bottom of the pile hidden, but they were in the house, you know. So he kind of knew. He knew exactly what was going on, you know. But, and before Little Richard, we had the Beatles, who, of course, adored Little Richard.
Yeah.
And absolutely adored him.
Because they would have been the people that obviously the British bands would have heard, like my mum and them and Derry listening to music. So they were the peers, they were the leaders, they were the kings of rock and roll. You look at Chuck Berry, Jerry Lee Lewis, and Little Richard, you know, there wasn't anybody on Eddie Cochran and the Blue Kids. There isn't, you know, it doesn't get any better than that. That's rock and roll. Anything else that comes from that's just, you know, a derivative of it, you know.
A version of it. Yeah, absolutely.
My dad talks about great images of the Rialto in Derry when the cinema was running up there, the most beautiful cinema and music hall. And the Gaird Can't Help It came into the cinema, and he said, literally, everybody went berserk. Once the music kicked in, they treated it like a dance. They were up dancing, jiving in the aisles. And he always remembers the Gaird Can't Help It and the technicolor of it, you know, seeing that for the first time as a young teenager, like, and they're just the Little Richard. So he would tell us that as he was playing the music, because he's the big Little Richard fan, my daddy. So as a kid, you just had those images, you know. And a friend of mine in London actually has Little Richard's hanky.
Really?
From a show. Yeah, it's framed. And Little Richard dabbed his head. And it's like, if you think the Kardashians wearing makeup, you want to see what this baby was wearing. It's covered in like orange brown makeup and like the black eyeliner. And it's dabbed this like the shroud of Turin. And he threw it under the audience and my friend caught it. And it's framed. And I was like, I want that.
Oh, my soul, Little Richard. Now, let's move it on a bit, Bronner, because I know you've talked about this a million times, but you would have come to the attention of a lot of people initially when The Commitments come out, the movie. If ever there was anybody more perfectly placed to slot into that role, yourself, you know, you knew this music, you could sing it, you knew the dances, you knew the moves. Was it as easy as that to get the part? I mean, was it were you a kind of a shoe-in in some sense? Or
I think my passion for soul, because I was, you know, 16 when I first started coming to Dublin. And I'm just, you know, was thinking about it today, actually. You know, like that's 30 years ago, you know what I mean? And I was literally the girl with, I had no real interest in boys. I mean, I fancied boys and I fancied rockabilly boys, but they had to look like a rockabilly. They had to look like Elvis, you know. But I had
Did you ever find one?
I did. Quite a few. Still finding them, love. And, but I was obsessed with music and I couldn't understand if people didn't get it. I still don't, and I drive my friends mad. They said, don't start doing the iPod DJing thing. I drive them mental. I know we're doing it. It's a tick I have to get rid of. Well, I probably will never get rid of it. But I had a bag of tapes. So I used to have like Marvin Gaye, Al Green, Aretha Franklin, Northern Soul, Candy Staten in the bag, right? And I couldn't understand that you wouldn't be as obsessed or want to sit down with me for 3 hours listening to these tapes. You know, you're from this club.
I know the feeling.
You know, and you still know that feeling. So I used to go.
People out here listening to this right now.
Exactly. Met my twin. My twin.
And even that, I might be being optimistic.
Oh, but listen, you know, it's just, I just think, will it ever cease? No, I don't think, and I hope it would never will. So this was my obsession. I think my passion for the soul music, firstly, sort of made me go to the Hubbards and say, you know, you need to see me for this film. I love this music. This is my music. I could, you know, I could be in this film. But I had a Derry accent. I certainly wasn't the greatest singer in the world. You know, I mean, I've got stronger and more confidence as I've gone on. But I wouldn't have been in any way putting myself as anybody with any sane mind would up alongside people like Aretha Franklin or anything like that. They were the singers to me. But I think it was my passion for it and my excitement for it that they kind of went there and right, well, she can act a wee bit, she's not the greatest singer, but get her in and we'll see what she can do. But I was just like, what do you mean you don't know this Al Green? What do you mean you don't know who Marvin Gaye is? What do you mean you don't know who Willie Mitchell is? So that's what it was, because I was like the sort of just who's that maniac from Derry with a bag of tits?
Yeah, but it's an interesting point, and it's happened with a lot of people that we've had in here on Sunday nights when I talk about how they've kind of, you know, made their mark in the world. At some point they pushed themselves forward. At some point they said, I can do that.
It was my love for the soul. I was like, you can't make this film without me. And that was literally, I thought, I was only 16. And I thought, well, I mean, that's all them songs. And you know, I mean, Dublin accent's a Dublin accent. We'll get the Dublin accent. So that's kind of how it all worked. And I think they just thought, oh, God, we'll probably never get rid of her now. She'll probably stand outside the set and wave in.
Now, of course, I mean, and I remember all that happening really well. First of all, you know, I remember there was a screening, presumably in Belfast, I guess, and, you know, various members of the cast were there. And this was before it took off. I was also getting bulletins from your sister, you know, how you were getting on, where it was, where you were, and you know, promoting the film and one thing and another. You couldn't have expected, though, that this was going to happen, you know, because music films rarely worked, you know. You know, they were always a bit, they were never quite believable, but this one did work.
This really worked, obviously. I mean, I think it wasn't until the sort of, you know, they saturated the colleges in America, and that's where they got the audiences, and they showed the movie for free, I think, in colleges around all the different state college, you know, campuses. And then when we went to America to promote it, so we went for like a 3 week tour, New York, Chicago and LA, and gigged it there. And, you know, Wilson Pickett, God have mercy on it, came to the end of every premiere and performed at the end, you know. And once it kind of went through that sort of, you know, porthole, and then we come back to Ireland and the premiere here, it was probably, you know, about, I mean, I can't really remember the whole time of it, but I remember about 2 or 3 months afterwards, it was just like massive. And then it was kind of scary because it was like, whoa, you know, so you were immediately recognisable everywhere you went. And, you know, but as a great, obviously as an actor or as an artist, it was a great thing to have in your CV. You
was
know,
that so. Your first time in America?
Yeah.
Right. So you're a mad music head, right? And the next thing you're in New York, and you're in these places where it's at, where the music happened, where the people still are, still playing.
Big time out.
You know, Wilson Pickett, who's a sort of mythological figure almost in the book and in the film, because he doesn't show up, you know, or he kind of does in the film, but you don't see him. And then, you know, suddenly you're singing with him. But then the real one was, the real big one was when I got the message again from your sister, you'll never believe who Brona met last night, Aretha.
I know.
Now, what was that like?
Well, it was nominated for a Grammy, the soundtrack. We went to New York to the Radio City. And we all went into the sound check at the beginning of the day, and there's a seat in front of us with her name, plaque, and beside her is James Brown. And beside James Brown's Dionne Warwick. And beside Dionne Warwick is Natalie Cole. Beside Natalie Cole is Bob Dylan, who didn't show up.
Good man, Bob.
Bob didn't show. No show, Bob. And, you know, the list went on. So you're standing there looking at these name plates going, is Aretha Franklin going to be sitting there the night in front of us? Is James Brown going to be sitting there in front? And they were. And we come up off this like riser thing, or the thing. Didn't do, you know, a particularly great performance, I think, because some of them guys are playing to a click. But it all went pear-shaped anyway. And like, you know, one of the dark moments of our lives. But anyway, we were nominated and we went there and we didn't win. I think REM won. We didn't expect to win. We were just so chuffed to be in New York. But I just thought, I would never invade anybody's space. I'm not that kind of person. I like to be left alone myself if I go out and about. But I just thought, it's Aretha.
I know.
And it's my mum. And it's the queen of soul. And I'll probably never, ever be in the same room as this woman again. So I was really polite. I just hung around at the back as she was coming out. And her beautiful, very gentle security guy just said, excuse me. I explained where I was from. And he kind of knew it was obviously one of the kids from this movie. And I said, I would just absolutely love to get a photograph from my mum. And he was extremely gentle. He said, I'll just ask Miss Aretha. And he asked Aretha and she went, that's fine, kid. And put her arm around him. So she snuggled up beside me. And I said, Aretha, I just want to say thank you for your music, for everything that you've ever given us. I said, you're hugely loved in Ireland and in Derry where I'm from. I said, I love you. My mum loves you. I said, I'd love a photograph, please. I said, Amazing Grace is my favourite album. And she went, thanks, kid. And we took a photograph. And then I just kept it and just developed it and sent it to my mum. And she collapsed nearly in the kitchen. And her friend Rosie and Harrison, the other Maud. So yeah, she was extremely pleasant and gentle. It was amazing. And I tweeted it, I think, when she died. I couldn't even speak. I didn't speak for 2 days. I couldn't stop crying. But obviously we all knew, you know, she wasn't well. I just couldn't believe the response to it. People were just so blown away.
Tell me about this. There's a thing that happens, you know, when someone like Aretha passes away, and, you know, there's been a lot of it in recent years, but people care about Bowie and Leonard Cohen and all sorts of people, and they pass away. And people are genuinely upset. Mm. And then you always get some kind of person saying, you know, why are people being upset about people they didn't know?
Mm. Well, I think what it is, it's the understanding of the artist needs the fans and the fans need the artist. You know, we all need comfort. We need redemption. We need something to look forward to. You can go home and play a track and it'll change your mood. You can play something to somebody, it'll heal in a certain way. It'll be uplifting because music is the great unifier. It brings people together, no matter what, across all divides, across all religions. You know this, and we'll talk about that now in another few songs about how it brings people together, especially in Belfast when we were growing up, right? So, for somebody like Aretha Franklin, or for somebody like, you know, any great soul artist of that time, what they stood for, not just as a woman, but what they stood for as a black woman at that time in the world, and the humility that that woman lived her life by. You learn from people like that every day of your life. You look at Aretha Franklin and you look at the background that she came from, which was a spiritual, you know, Baptist background. People that needed that to keep going. She was from quite an affluent background because her father toured all the time and took her where all the time as like a protege. But, you know, people find comfort in that. If people find comfort in the church and in church music, then so be it. That's fantastic. That's what she was. She was a spiritual singer like Mahalia Jackson. That's where she came from. So, you know, when you find comfort in an artist like that, you can be as guaranteed that that artist has found the same comfort in fans. And when they go and they see what they do to people. They change people's night, they change people's lives, they bring people together. So one doesn't live without the other. Mm. A band can't go out in the road if there's not 10 people or 10,000 people or 100,000 people to play. So we all need each other, you know, no matter what it is. And that's what music is. Music is beyond language, beyond religion, beyond any creed or faith. Music does not have a passport.
And then that connection can be a lifetime.
That's it.
A lifetime long.
That's it.
And then part of it disappears.
Exactly.
So it's bound to be upset.
You know, so you look at that life and what people, and you say, what they gave me. And, you know, it's the only thing that nobody can say to you, that's not right or that's not wrong. If a kid likes the soundtrack to Frozen, they love the soundtrack to Frozen. If somebody likes One Direction, they love One Direction. If they love the Spice Girls, great. You know, I happen to love stuff that people might not hear of or know, and they think it's a bit weird, but that's my love, and it gives me happiness, it gives me comfort, you know. And somebody like Aretha Franklin, at that time, the level of musicianship, the voice, the people that she had around her, and you're talking 1968 right now, you're going into the southern states of America where black people were completely and utterly being persecuted, and she goes into a studio by a group of white soul musicians, you know, that adored her, that loved her. I mean, it was really treacherous for her husband to take her down there and Jerry Wexler to take her down there. It's dangerous times, you
and
know.
This track comes from Aretha now, doesn't it?
This comes from Aretha now, her 13th studio album. So this is how prolific Aretha was. Obviously, it's a Bill Brunsey song, famous by Ray Charles, but it's just the musicianship, her playing, the band. It's just Aretha at her peak.
Aretha Franklin, Night Time Is the Right Time, the choice of Brona Gallagher, who's with me in studio tonight, picking all the music. I knew Aretha would come in and I was curious to see which track you'd pick.
Yeah.
But that's from an album called Aretha Now, which is also my favourite Aretha record. Apart from the live gospel one, which, and that film's going to come out, apparently.
Yes, apparently, because the footage was unearthed.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So we've got to see
Amazing
that.
Amazing Grace.
Now, after the commitments, Brona, and I will forget the order of this, and we're not here for a chronological interview, so don't worry about this. But what do you do next? You talked about the fact that you were being recognised and everybody knew the film and everybody knew the people in it. Did you think, right, I'm now a professional actor. I need to work. I need to find more work. Or do you have agents working your case at that point?
Yeah.
Or how did that go?
I had agents then in Dublin. Yeah, Dara O'Malley, who was great, and I went to the Abbey Theatre for about 2.5 years on and off, doing about 3 different plays, I think, and then I, so that was about 1920. So at about 21, I then moved to London and I joined the incredible director called Yukiro Ninagawa. He was a Japanese, very visual director, sort of state-of-the-art, you know, very technical, sort of advanced lighting systems and projections and stuff. But we did a production of Peer Gynt, and we went on tour with that for, God, the guts of a year, and then did a couple of films after that. I went to America, did Pulp Fiction, went come back, and then I joined another theatre company, because I loved theatre, I loved live work, stage work, and I joined a company called Theatre de Complicity, so Simon McBurney's company in London, and it was 5 years with him. So that to me is my favourite work, you know, in the
kind of, I want to talk about that and Simon McBurney and just and as a separate thing.
Mm-hmm.
When you get a movie like Pulp Fiction or something like that, were you in a position to treat that as a job, or, oh wow, this is a big Hollywood film?
It was a low budget film by an unknown director, bar Reservoir Dogs.
Yeah.
And we had gone, there was a gang of us in London for the weekend, myself and Colm McInerney and some of the lads from the Frames, Binzer and Colm and myself, and we went to see Reservoir Dogs on Tottenham Court Road. On the cinema up on the left, the screen, and this is a film. We were all staying in the Columbia Hotel, and we went down there.
Lancaster Gate.
Yeah.
The Rock and Roll Hotel.
The Curly Bow.
That's some place.
We used to stay there all the time. We loved in it. Don't know how we didn't.
What?
It was the Rock and Roll Hotel.
Flashbacks.
Listen, we could put it in the memoirs, you know what I mean? It will someday, but what happened in the Curly Bow stayed in the Curly Bow. But we went down to see the show, Reservoir Dogs, and I remember about 20 minutes in thinking, this is Shakespeare. Who's this dude? Jesus, this is brilliant. And then about a year and a half later, maybe, I was in LA, and the agent that we had at the time, So there's the guy doing this movie, Tarantino. I was like, oh, I have seen that. It's a brilliant film. And I went and met them. And then tiny, low budget, you know, don't forget, it wasn't a big movie. I mean, the Weinsteins got involved, obviously, and then you got Harvey Keitel and Bruce Willis and a lot of big names. And then about a year later, I was in Glasgow doing a film. And my mum rang me to the hotel and she said, Mir, that film you did in America, Pulp Fiction. Mir is another word they say in Derry instead of come here. Mir. It's after one of the Palm d'Or. And there's Uma and John up collecting the award, Uma and Quentin up collecting the award. And I was like, all right, really? And then I was in this film for about a month in Glasgow, and it obviously rains all the time in Glasgow. So one of the days I was off, I thought, oh, I must go and see it in the film in the cinema. And I got a bag of chips.
So here, hang on a minute. Back up a minute. Are you saying that you did your parts in the film before Harvey Keitel and all these guys were on board?
The cast, Harvey Keitel, and then they got the cast, Bruce Willis. So then they were happy with what they had because it sort of snowballed in LA.
Because you were in the scene with Travolta.
Yeah.
But were you in another scene? Was it all that scene with Travolta and Uma Thurman?
Yeah.
Right, okay.
Yeah, and then they just they snowballed the script around. I think a lot of people were listening to it or reading it, sorry. And then, you know, the word got around and I knew Tim Roth and his wife, Nikki, at the time. So we were kind of hanging out with them and they were saying, you know, so-and-so's involved now, so-and-so's attached now. And obviously Tim was attached and... You know, a lot of buddies that were in Reservoir Dogs beforehand. So then it obviously just sort of snowballed and it was the hot script then. And then Quentin sort of kept his word and said, you know, we'll get you in for a wee part, which they did. Because I was reading for Rosanna's part. But
have you any recollection of how that scene was directed?
Brilliantly. About 3 minutes into watching him working. I mean, the rehearsals were interesting because I had to rehearse with them for a few days. And but then you seen him on set, I was like, oh. I remember, and I wasn't even conscious of watching. You don't watch directors. You're 21. You haven't a clue. You're just sitting there staring at John Travolta going, that's John Travolta. I was obsessed with John Travolta. Like what, you know, teenage girl wasn't growing up watching Grease and Saturday Night Fever. And, you know, wee bit starstruck. But he was so lovely and down to earth and he made me completely at ease. He was a lovely man. And then I remember him just like ticking the scene by the throat. I'll never forget the energy shift in the room. And he was like, it's in my brain. That's the vibe I got. It's in my brain. And I'll tell you exactly what I want. And I was like, oh, Jesus, this boy's good. Oh, this boy's good. I remember just thinking it. Mm. And then like, boom. Then went to see the film, you know, a year and a half later in Glasgow. And I thought, uh-oh. Because just the music, as soon as it started, you were like, this is brilliant.
Because you would be inclined to think, I don't know how these things work at all. But I think as if someone watching that film, you might think it was improvised. Or a lot of it was improvised. But you're saying it wasn't.
No. Every word was scripted.
Yeah.
Every word was scripted.
The Samuel L. Jackson scene, I think you would know that was a script that he'd learned and delivered like a proper actor.
Yeah, incredible.
But the scene you were in, I would have thought there was so much chaos and energy going on there. You think some of that must have been improvised, but no.
There was a 3-day rehearsal just for that scene. And even that line at the end when Rosanna goes, you know, trippy. I remember him asking her to come up with a line. What would you say? You know, what would you say after something like this happens in your home? They're obviously all supposed to be very high. And she came up with that. So it's all scripted, no? I mean, he knew exactly what he was doing.
Next choice is Toots and the Maytals.
So look, 68 Aretha, 69. This is going on in Jamaica and Kingston. And, you know, the movie, when it came out in 1972, The Harder They Come. If you haven't seen The Harder They Come, this introduced basically reggae to the world. And this record, not just obviously Toots, but Jimmy Cliff, who's one of my favourite singers, who's one of the greatest singers, I think. This record, this soundtrack, just blew my brains apart. Because I'm in soul world and then you go to Belfast. Because my sister joined the BBC and started working with you. And I was allowed to go up to Belfast for the weekend to my sister. Little did they know, we were in Laveries with all the skinheads and all the rockabillies listening to reggae. And when this song came in, it's like somebody smashed your world apart. It just took you. I was like, right, what is this? What is this sound? And it was the skinheads and all the gear and the terrible sound systems that they had in Laveries. And this sound just... I don't know, I'll never get it. It was the most potent thing I've ever heard in my life. And you were like, well, I'm from the bog side, Kingston. There's a similarity there. There's a, you know, there is a symmetry. There's no doubt about it. And the more you explored and explored, you realise it was. So, you know, this is the music, the pressure drop. Greatest song.
pressure drop there from Toots and the Maytals, a choice of Brona Gallagher is with me in studio. You really do associate that with Belfast. But yep. You weren't living in Belfast though, Brona,
no,
were you? You were
just 16,
sort of up and down, yeah.
Aye, about 15 or 16 and Louise started working. Well, what age was Louise? 16, 17. I was 16 and Louise would have been 18 and she went up to the BBC. So I was allowed to go up and stay the weekend with her. But we used to go on round Lavery's and the Skinheads would be all playing this music. And you would swap tapes. Once you got to know blokes, you would swap tapes with them. And I would do a tape up of all stuff we had in the house, like Al Green and, you know, Aretha, Marvin Gaye, Jackie Wilson. And then they would do you up the reggae. Because you couldn't afford to buy it. Don't forget, you know, when I had I had $2.49 and I bought off Terry Hooley when we went up to look at the universities. So this is probably a year after that. So 16, 17, went to these Good Vibrations, stalked out where it was, found out where the shop was, and I bought Muddy Waters live at Kelly's. And I didn't eat for the day because I didn't care. I just bought, I knew it was after this record. And Terry was like, what are you doing in here? The school uniform and all. And of course, I thought, who's this mad geezer? Now he's like a really close family friend. But that was how we used to go up. And then going on to Belfast and on a Saturday, so you go into town and we used to be looking for the Levi's and the crepe shoes and the, you know, the 1950s clothes. And there was a shop, a denim shop that specialised in denim and American vintage clothes on just off Castle, just opposite City Hall. I think it was American Classics or something it was called. And you used to walk down the street and there used to be cranking blues. So that was another brain melt. Then you were like, well, who's that? Oh, this is Muddy Waters. Who's that? That's Howlin' Wolf. And they sort of laughed and they're always too cool for school. The guys, you know, with the cool beards and the hair all slicked back. Who's this wee girl? You know, and I'd say no. And they'd write that down. Who is this? And it was Howlin' Wolf that was another florgy, you know, one of the greatest singers ever. And that sound again, which totally transported you to the South, to Mississippi, to that area, which was, there was so much pain in the music, but there was so much hope in the music and just the simplicity, but the brilliance of it. And this track is moving. This is when they were signed to Chess in 1973. And I find it really difficult to figure out who's playing the lead guitar. And a few of my friends said, oh, it's this guy. It's that guy. But we don't think it is. We don't know who it is playing guitar. But it's Howlin' Wolf at his finest and one of the greatest guitar solos I've ever heard.
Well, his guitar player was usually Hubert Sumlin.
I know, but this is
some. Yeah, well, you see, he did some. Are you sure this wasn't recorded in Britain? Because he did some sessions with some of those guys. You know,
possibly.
Some
I'm totally open to being told who it is because I could never find it because it's very little written about this actual session. Just tells you it was from 1973.
But you say it was Chess. It was recorded in America.
Chess,
all right, okay. Because I know he did some sessions with, you know, as a lot of them did with the London-based blues guys. But
yeah.
Anyway. Here we go, moving from Howlin' Wolf. And that's moving from Howlin' Wolf. The choice of Brona Gallagher is with me in studio tonight, picking all the tracks. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back. And this is Mystery Train on RTE Lyric FM. Brona Gallagher with me in studio tonight, picking all the tracks, and we're having a ball here. Mm-hmm. And some great, great music, Brona. You mentioned that after all the, you know, between Pulp Fiction and The Commitments and one thing and another, you got involved with Simon McBurney's theatre company, mm-hmm. which is a big, big deal. He's a very serious actor and a great actor.
He's incredible, man.
What's the approach of that? Tell me about that theatre company and what its approach was, how it went about things.
They were all Cambridge graduates and basically invented this theatre company when they were at Cambridge, Annabel Arden and Simon McBurney. And they went about England in a van saying basically the greatest thing, you know, the next big thing. And nobody knew who they were. So they created this sort of false image about themselves. But they were extraordinary actors and devisers of literature into live theatre. So they would take a book. So that's how they're basically template, you know, I was born. They take a book. They would use a lot of early John Berger writing and they would, from these chapters, devise what the storyline was within the chapters and put it on their feet and get up there and vocalise it and tell the story.
Mm.
So through that, they went from small theatre company turn to, you know, one of the best British theatre companies there is, really, and one of the best in the world.
And you were with them for what, 5 years?
5 years.
What theatrical training had you had, Brona?
None.
None?
I auditioned for 6 drama schools in England when I was about 18. But no, about 17, between that and sort of about a year before the commitment, I suppose. I was about 16. When you're leaving to do your, you know, going to do your A-levels or whatever, and I didn't get into any. So I then always wanted to train. I knew it felt slightly inadequate that I didn't have any training. I wanted to do sort of theatre, classic sort of theatre. And my agent at the time, Penny, she was only 22. She said, you know, 23, I think you should just get over here and get as much theatre under your belt as you can. But I didn't really get into any theatre jobs because I had no training, I had no Shakespeare experience. I wasn't great with text. And I'd obviously done a lot more film work. But then come 24 would have been, Frank McGuinness was doing his version of Brecht's The Caucasian Chalk Circle, and Frank championed me to Simon. But I mean, I'm walking in there, we know, you know, I can't play that instrument basically. And but he took a wee shine to me and he said, you know, I kind of don't know what I'm going to do with this wee girl. She's no training. All of these young actors were coming from Jacques Lecoq, coming straight out of some of the best schools in Europe, from dance, movement, you know, vocal and musicians as well. And but I was his wee wild card and he brought me in and I did 3 big shows with them and toured the world. It's my favourite work I've ever done, and a lot of people don't know it, but, you know, it's some of the greatest theatre that's ever really been made of the last sort of 20, 30 years.
How did you feel in the middle of all that, Brona? Because sometimes it can be hard enough for people to go into that world.
Aye.
Even if they're educated to the hilt and trained to the hilt and all the rest of it, you know, we've got this thing, you know, you're hanging out with these Cambridge graduates who know this stuff intimately, and you don't have a dot of theatrical training.
No.
Now, how did you get yourself through that, if you know what I mean? There must have been a real force of will there, actually, or maybe you ignore the voices in your head saying that you shouldn't be there.
I mean, you know, I think the voices in your head are always there, and as you get older, maybe they're louder, but I think at 24... I just sort of, you know, I was so in awe of these people. I was so in awe of how they moved me. I had a dance background in the sense I did dance as a kid, you know, did ballet and modern dances. And I still to this day adore dance. I just think it's one of the greatest forms of expression, you know, when you see great dance, no matter what genre it is. And I just rose to the challenge and I really trusted Simon and I knew that he trusted me. And he knew that I had something I was coming from, you know, we're poles apart in our upbringing. He's middle class, British, Cambridge, working class.
He always plays a great spy in a movie, doesn't
he? He's a wonderful actor as well as being, you know, a fantastic, I mean, he's the greatest director, bar, I suppose, Tarantino and, you know, Alan Parker and that. You know, Simon's the best director I've ever worked with. And it's very, very hard to work with anybody after him. It's as if you've had the love of your life and you'll never love anybody like him. Because the guy's a genius, and I don't use that word lightly, you know.
Well, if you just joined us, it's Simon McBurney that we're talking about.
Yeah, from Theatre to Complicity. You know, it's extremely difficult work. But I mean, as I say, polar opposites. And I'm from the bog side in Derry, but he had a huge interest in politics. He had a huge compassion for where we were from. He knew what it was about. And although he's from, you know, sort of military Cambridge, you know, England. And he just knew that the Caucasian Chalk Circle was a universal story of injustice, which I was, you know, obsessed with at the time. So he had compassion for me and I had compassion for him and what he was trying to do through his work. And the bulk of his work is about injustice. So there was a huge understanding there and a love. And I just knew he was hardcore. And I just thought, rise to the challenge, you know. And you went into boot camp for 8 weeks. So you're beat into shape. And, you know, you're incredibly fit by the end of it. But I just, you know, you're working with Spanish actors, Icelandic actors, Basque actors, you know, American, Finnish, Swedish, people from all over the world. And they're just all extraordinary human beings. And the British actors too. And I just loved them. I loved every one of them. I had the time of my life. And we toured the world doing Bruno Schultz and Brecht, you know. And other work we did and loads of workshops and stuff like that. But I loved it, you know.
Do you know the way I often see actors on big talk shows on television and they all say, oh, I much prefer the theatre. And yet they're not doing the theatre. They're doing high-paying movies, rubbish movies half the time. And they say that they love the theatre. But in your case, you actually do love the theatre and would prefer theatre to movies, would you?
A lot of the time. I mean, I think because the buzz is the acting live and the, you know, you're in a room. I mean, I just finished this year doing Geralt from the North Country, the Conor McPherson play and the music of Bob Dylan. So I did that for 6 months, you know, on and off in the West End and in the Old Vic. And you're going out every night to, you know, 1,300 people. You know, that to me is what an actor is. You know, you're out there and you're playing music, you're singing your heart out, you know, playing the drums and singing Bob Dylan every night, and who I adore anyway, and Conor, who I adore. You know, and you're there just going, this is it, you know, this is as good as it gets. This is why I'm an actor, you know what I mean? Rather than sitting around in a film set, which I love films as well, but it's all the technical stuff, and maybe I feel I've got more scope in the theatre. I've been given more, you know, challenges in the theatre, playing against type to what I am, you know, as opposed to the sort of quirky, weird woman in the corner telling people off or whatever. You know, the challenges have been there more in the theatre, you know. And it's live, and that's where you grow your hairy chest. You know, you're out there going, you know, you got to be hardcore to do this. That's love it. Love the challenge.
Next choice, Otis Redding.
Otis Redding. You know, there's a lot of great soul singers, right? There's no doubt about it. You know, there's James Carr as well. You got to remember, when we talk about Otis Redding, who is, you know, Otis Redding, let's face it, you can't even describe the guy. There's also James Carr, so check him out too. But this, to me, Steve Cropper, again, producing, you know, one of the last recordings of the late, great Otis Redding. And it's the construction of the song. It's a Benny Goodman song, Glory of Love. But it's when the drums kick in, and it's the timing of them, and then his voice soaring over the top of it. Just, you know, Otis really peaking. From, you know, sitting in the dock of the bay, and God of Mercy was killed not long after it. But just, you know, you'd spend hours listening to Otis Redding and crying, drinking tea.
And there's Otis Redding there, the Glory of Love, the choice of Brona Gallagher, who's with me in studio. Brona, I just want to move on a bit from, well, it's not entirely moving on from the acting, because the two are combined, at least in what you've been doing with the Conor McPherson play, the Bob Dylan play. How did that go? How would you describe that? Now, I still haven't seen it. I remember Conor telling me about this thing coming up. He says, you know, and it all had to be a bit, you know, cloak and dagger, because his Bobness was involved, you know. But it's been a huge hit here and in Broadway.
Great. You know? We did a London, two runs in London at the Old Vic, and then under the Noel Coward this year, and started this year. And then we wrapped up in March, and then they have just produced a new production in Broadway, which has been a huge success as well. So, I mean, it was just extraordinary. I mean, a wonderful group of people, but an amazing play by Conor, you know, an extraordinary piece to create this world in Duluth, Minnesota during the Great Depression, and, you know, to basically hint at maybe this young writer that they're sort of one of the boys in the family that the play is written around their home. Do you write this extraordinary play about human survival and human, you know, secrecy and lies and mental health and loss and greed, and then to parallel this with the songs of Bob Dylan, which just weaved in and out. So it wasn't a musical per se, it was a play with music. And then we all got to sing, because everybody in the play was a singer or a musician, as well as an actor. So it'll be good to do that every night.
Now, do you think twice when you're offered a gig like that? Because I'll tell you why. You know, when someone's, you know, if Conor was to say to me, right, I'm doing this thing, you know, my first instinct was wrong about everything that's ever been a success. You know, from Riverdance on, you know, Riverdance, that won't work. Do you know, Once was another one.
I know.
That's never going to work.
I auditioned for Friends in LA in 1992 after The Commitments, and I went, Friends? What a terrible name. This will never work. And sort of phoned on the audition. Went down there, yeah, whatever.
Well,
never work.
Well, if you hadn't phoned in, you could be still on our TV screens seven times a day.
Listen. Yeah.
But you know that, that's the thing. After a while, you must develop your own critical instincts, you know? And Friends, I wondered about this thing Conor was attempting. I, you know, how are you gonna do this? How can we do this? You know, okay, Dylan's giving you free rein with the songs, but still. Would you, when you get offered something like that and you hear the name Conor McPherson and you hear the name Bob Dylan, do you just as an actor go, better do that? Or do you read the script first and figure out whether or not you can really do it or not? Or even do you start to think, that mightn't work, I don't want to be involved in it?
Sometimes, it just depends. I think what's important is to have a conversation with somebody and just sort of get a feeling of it and trust your instinct. You know, but I just think Conor's such an extraordinary writer and such a unique writer, and, you know, just, you know, he really does have an incredible gift, you know, to create new worlds. And I think that's what all great writers have. And he no doubt has that in bucket loads. And then he didn't rise to the challenge lightly. He knew exactly, the precipice that you're standing off, sure, if you're going to align yourself alongside Dylan's, you know, music. So, I mean, Connor's work was just so well excavated and he'd so well prepared himself to come into that rehearsal room and knew every note of every song and, you know, had basically just ensconced himself in Dylan for the few years before it. And, you know, the choice of his songs were, you know, brilliant. And, you know, he was coming in there guns blazing, you know, so we felt very safe that he knew exactly what he was doing. So I don't think anybody takes something like that lightly. You know, you don't...
You should have taken Friends more seriously.
I should have taken Friends more seriously. It might be, you know, it could own RTE.
And then I'd be on every hour on the
You'd
hour.
Be on every hour. It would just be me and you talk about Soul. RTE would just be me and you playing Soul with a webcam showing you the albums. Look at this from 1954.
It's an idea.
I know, I'll tell you.
Here's one of your own. Can I pick this one?
You can.
Hand of My Heart from Brona Gallagher, and that's my choice tonight. Brona's picking all the other music, but I wanted to hear a track from Brona's very fine album, Gather Your Greatness. Mm-hmm. Brona, you were always a singer, and the singing was there. Although, in fairness to you, earlier on, you said when you started with The Commitments that you didn't consider yourself a singer or much of a singer.
No, I think I just lacked the confidence, you know. I just think it took me a long time to sort of get in front of people. I think, you know, when people say soul music, you know, and I kind of understand now, you know, you're opening up any inhibitions, you know, you're very vulnerable as a singer. And I think what's when people open up their heart and just let that go and open up basically their soul, their chest, I think that's when you really get into singing. I mean, you don't have to be singing soul music, as it were, to be a soul singer. But I sort of just, you know, over the years really wanted to sing and started to write tunes, I suppose, when I was sort of 18, 19.
When did the drumming start?
The drama started just after Complicity. I was about 25, 26, and I finished the first show. And we were doing a lot of darbuka and a lot of, you know, just handheld drums during one of the shows and rehearsals. And I just thought, I want to learn to play drums because I was obsessed with drums. Obsessed, obviously, with Ringo Starr, but Zigaboo Modeleste from the Meters.
I saw him play once.
Oh, my God. I mean, what a drummer.
Oh.
And, you know, Tony Allen, Fela Kuti's drummer, and John Bonham, Keith Moon, you know, all the great rock and roll drummers. And I just bought myself a Pearl Export in Dublin and started to learn to play and listening to, you know, Phil Rudd and listening to, you know, all the sort of soul stuff that I loved. And then I went to London again and my friend John Reynolds bought me, whilst on tour in America, he bought me a 1967 Champagne Sparkle Ludwig. So, 22.
Nice.
Hello, thank you. You're my friend for life. So, I was given the stunning vintage Ludwig and just practiced, you know. And I mean, I'm not the most, you know, flamboyant drummer. I just love that Al Jackson sort of sitting holding the groove kind of beat. And that's what I did. So, I love drums. So, I played drums in the Dylan show. And I was only saying to myself last night, I must get that kid out. But so I just love drums, you know.
And then, you see, I started, you know, again, keeping up with you when you were away, just hearing things from your sister and one thing and another. And then I started hearing Brian Eno being mentioned.
Brian
Eno. And I thought, right. Hang on a minute. I was just trying to figure this out. I said, what is Brona doing with Brian Eno?
And what was I doing with Brian? We were usually eating Lebanese food and listening to the Shangri-La's, funny.
Because Brian's doo-wop.
He loves his doo-wop. You know, I didn't really know who Brian was. I mean, I knew he was like Brian Eno and I knew he'd worked with David Bowie. Sort of. And it just wasn't really my music. And there was a U2 connection, sort of. So we met in the wee Lebanese cafe one morning, myself and
There's
John.
There's no sort of about it.
Sort of, yeah. But I just, you know, you just don't, you know, they were all too white for me. Do you know what I mean? I was like, yeah. I was kind of like, oh, yeah, your man, he's a bit weird. And, that dude. And like an artist dude. But we sat down and had Lebanese food. And it was a lovely like, Tuesday morning. And I was in the Royal Court. Doing one of Connor's plays, Dublin Carol. And we sat down and Brian says, John Reynolds, who bought me the kid, John says, this is Brian. And Brian loves the soul music like you. Bruno loves doo-wop music. And I was like, yeah, doo-wop. So that was it. So we started talking and we've never stopped. So we just started talking about the Shangri-La's, the Ronettes, about the Brill Building, about all the early girl groups, about the Sweet Inspirations, about the great backing singers. And then he was like, well, what are you doing now? And I was like, oh, I'm going to work. Well, come on up to the studio. So I went to the studio and I was like, okay, I've met my best friend who's as big as an obsessive with me. And it was about the music.
Yeah.
So looking through all the records, oh my God, you've got this. Oh my God, you've got that. So that is what happened. And I used to go down to the studio, listen to stuff. And then the penny started to drop. Then I would pull out records like, jeekers, Brian. And when I says, Do you know that song, The Great Curve? Do you know that band Talking Heads? Yes. That's right. There's a song and she said, rolling, do da do. And he was like, yes, I was on a bit of a roll back then. And I was like, hmm? And he was like, yes, I produced, I wrote that. And I was like, oh, didn't know that. Mortified. Redner, out the door. But that is what happened. And then I kind of went, oh, David Bowie. Oh, David Bowie. Oh, David Bowie. So then I kind of dropped.
Yeah.
I really did not. I didn't really know. I didn't care. You know, and, you know, to me, he's in a huge...
But did he play on something you did, or did you play on something he did?
He sings on my first album, Precious Soul. So that would have been, you know, whatever year that was, 2004. And I said, I'm making a record. So I let him hear it, and he loved it. And he offered to do strings and backing vocals on one of the songs, or a couple of the songs. So he wrote some strings and some keyboards and sang on some of the stuff. And then on the second album, he just said, you're absolutely playing a blind here. You don't need me. Go for it. Then the third album, The Gather Your Greatness, he said, I want to hear this, want to hear this. So I have to sit him down, and it's me and Hammond. It's like Yugandi Brian's. I call it like the Orgasmatron. You know, in the Woody Allen movies, he's got these strange objects. You sit there and he plays it through some weird instrument, like with a spoon or something hanging out of it. And he played it. And he was like, yes, yes. And listens. And he goes, right, I want to play this song. Can I play a bit on that? So I've got an idea for this. So I just, me and Connor would just send him, or Connor would, I haven't a clue. Connor would send him all the files. He just puts his vibe on it and sends it back. So that's kind of how it works. I mean,
it's amazing, you know, though, for a guy who's known as a kind of a scientist and a very cerebral,
yeah,
and clearly is a very, very, very smart person.
Yes.
He just loves singing.
Loves singing.
More than anything.
Loves singing. He has a group every Tuesday night in London, the Elegant Singers, which we started, whatever, 17 years ago. And you're going in and you're literally singing, today I met the boy I'm going to marry. And he's there, ooh, giving it socks. He is giving it Bobby socks and the blue jeans. He's obsessed. Because that's the music he grew up with. And folk music. And I'm constantly being told to shut up because I talk too much. And I'm just like, all right, calm down. And it's Graham Parsons. It'd be old, beautiful, you know, Emmylou, old Carole King. You know, just loves music, and they all, and it'll be people from a non-musical background. It's friends of his that are in horticulture, physics. You meet some fantastic quantum physicists, and we all sit around. I say, in a nutshell, hit me with the quantum physics. What is that stuff? So, he's great, great supporter, and he's just a great guy. You know,
oh, I'll tell you, Brian Eno. When's the next session? We should all go. We could run a bus
tomorrow night.
Yeah,
we'll get the Ryanair over. All right. Oh no, he's a great guy.
Oh, I've jumped the gun here. Only 9 years in Swedish. And that's Chuck Berry there, Sweet Little Rock and Roller. Brona, I didn't give you a chance to introduce that one. I was so excited by your Brian Eno story, I hit the switch. So that's Chuck Berry.
Yeah, I mean, there's just such, you know, there's just such raw jewels in Chuck Berry's music. And, you know, you see people like Keith Richards then, falling down, you know, when they meet Chuck, and obviously he nearly did fall down because Chuck Berry punched him. He said, I was the greatest hit Chuck ever had because he touched his guitar. But, you know, the raw bones, again, the structure of rock and roll, and somebody like Chuck Berry, not just as a showman, but just those songs and being able to play around me all them chords, just reinvent. And there's so many Chuck Berry songs, but for some reason that one, just, I don't know, it just makes me want to get up.
And always great lyrics as well.
Yeah.
You know? But they were very, I'm not knocking him because he's great, but they were very deliberate. I mean, he deliberately wrote lyrics that would appeal to every possible part of the constituency.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and particularly the white teenagers. I mean,
yep,
he wrote songs that they would like.
Mm-hmm.
And he brought in Cuban music and all sorts of rhythms in there too. But lyrically, he was very smart.
Yeah, he was a smart man, and great businessman, which people needed to learn at that time because so many artists from the African-American culture were getting ripped off. But he was, put the money in a bag at the front of the stage, and then I got the gig.
Yeah.
That's it.
And I'm not going on, double the money.
No, double the money, that's it.
And he would drive himself to the gig. I saw him do that. I saw him driving out of Vicar Street one night down Thomas Street, yeah.
Chuck.
Yeah, he'd run, because that way nobody else is getting paid to do it. You know?
Exactly, that's a good cut at the middle, man.
It's extraordinary.
I want to start doing that when I pass my driving test. Give myself the gig, give me the money. What money?
And he just chucked his guitar, you know, in the hold of the plane.
Would he?
Yeah, and they'd say, well, it might get damaged. And he just said, deductible.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. He travelled with a toothbrush, basically. You know? Yeah. Anyway.
That gives a whole new meaning to the term. On the road.
On the road. So, Bob Marley next.
Bob.
Where do you, when you hear Bob Marley's music, where does that locate your life? Where were you then?
Well, I mean, probably the bog side again, you know, hearing him growing up. But, you know, you're obviously, I think Legend was what we all had, you know, when I was about 17, 18. But it's not the, obviously, sort of, when I came down to live in Dublin, that you start to really sort of dissect the records and the early, very, very early Lee Scratch Perry stuff from, you know, within Kingston. And then you realise the impact that Bob Marley, when they came to London and they came into Notting Hill, and at the time when reggae music, you know, was just the man in London and Notting Hill, where I spent, you know, almost 20 years of my life living on and off as well. The importance of this band as a movement coming into to which was basically Jamaican England. And, you know, somebody like Chris Blackwell, they picked this band up, this group of vegetarians, don't forget, you know, coming into London at the time, and the workmanship that they had.
It's strange that you should single out that they were vegetarians.
Because they were starving. There's loads of stories about them trying to get them, because they were, you know, they weren't properly looked after by all accounts, that they weren't fed properly. They were obviously Rastafarians. They didn't eat what the people were giving them. But, you know, this, you know, extraordinary human being, not just Bob Marley, but the band with him, but, you know, what he stood for. And, you know, a humanitarian and a tough dude. You know, these guys were not spiritual guys sitting around. You know, they were like, where's our money? Where's our gig? They're Rastafarians. And they were, you know, they'd knock you down as quick as look at you. But just to bring that culture into, you know, which was obviously a huge Jamaican Caribbean community, Notting Hill, Kensal Rise, and to play this music, you know, and for somebody like Chris Blackwell to take this band and obviously to become the icons that they were, you know, when you once you tip your toes into Bob Marley, I think everybody else just falls off the, you know, the radar for a while, and you cannot believe how prolific this band were, how extraordinary the musicianship was amongst those musicians. And this track from Exodus, Natural Mystic, we used to sit around in our flats in Rathmines and we're blown away by the production of the song, because what he's done as Chris Blackwell, to me, you're in the jungle. To me, you're in the jungle, right? And it sort of never starts and it never stops. It fades up and you're there at 21. Whoa, man, he's fading it up. And it fades up the song. So the song actually becomes louder as you're listening to it. And it's just that sound of, to me, just, you know, Jamaica.
It's already on. Brown is correct. I'm already playing the record.
It fades in, you
know. It's coming. And in my memory of this as well, Brown, is that this was a big pop record. Everybody had it.
You know,
huge hit.
Yeah, yeah.
There's nothing strange or outlandish about this. Everybody seemed to have this record.
I know.
This was 1977, Exodus. Here it comes. It's been on for a while, but as Brown says,
it's coming. It's coming.
Here it is. Bob Marley and the Wailers from the Exodus album, Natural Mystic, the opening track on that album from 1977. The choice, Brona Gallagher, is with me in studio tonight. I haven't heard that in a while, Brona. Thank you.
It is a cracker, isn't it?
You know? It's just great. 77, though.
I know. There's so many.
77, you see people, if you talk to music people of our vintage about 77, they'll all start talking about punk. But that was 77 as well, as was a lot of other stuff. But, you know, the history books kind of go around 77 was the year of punk and the Pistols and all that stuff. Anyway, Bob Marley and the Wailers. James Brown is on your list.
Yeah.
I'm not surprised.
The Godfather.
When he was sitting in front of you at the Grammys, that must have been very strange. It must have been.
Well, he was very encouraging. He was kind of nodding and digging it, though we think we went off beat. As I say, we were doing this backing track. But I mean, I think he was just out of jail. he was going through his very, very up and down period. So it was just out of jail. So I was just so glad to see him. I mean, you can't believe it, James Brown sitting there. I mean, James Brown for us, you know, when you're growing up on whatever limited footage you would have seen on the TV, I mean, Mull and Fuller, come there, quick, quick, quick. quick, Wayne's quick, quick. And you see James Brown dancing, you just be like, what is that? What is that meteor that just came out of the sky? Yeah. You know, and, you know.
You see, people take for granted now that you can dial these things up on YouTube and so on. But there was, you know, up until relatively recently, the chances are you mightn't have seen James Brown ever. And as you say, this a sudden appearance on television would actually be mind-blowing.
It would have, my brain couldn't handle it.
Because you may have seen Michael Jackson at that stage or a few other people, but then you see this other guy in black and white and you think, what?
You see this other guy in black and white that looked to me as a kid that it was speeded up. Mm. And, you know, obviously, you know, the history of James Brown and the poverty and the, you know, the devastation that he came from as a child. He grew up in a brothel. Horrific upbringing, tragic stuff, you know, because you look back at, you know, footage now you see of all the incredible musicians that he worked with and people that were, you know, obviously extremely loyal to him, that knew his genius, you know, but he was extremely troubled guy, you know, and behind the incredible showmanship there was, you know, a lot of pain, you know, not just within him, but with the people that stood by him for 20, 30 years, you know, but regardless of that,
he certainly reinvented the music,
didn't
he?
You never will see anything like it. I mean, Michael Jackson, obviously, you know, you can never deny that. You can't teach people that. You can't install that, no matter how much you train a child or a musician. That is a God-given gift, like Prince. But Michael Jackson, you know, James Brown. I mean, you see James Brown dancing, and not just that. You know, for somebody that, you know, didn't essentially read or write music, just what was coming out of him. You know, he was a conduit for that. And, you know, he invented that music. There's no doubt about it. So this, you know, there's all, obviously all the classic early James Brown stuff. But this is 88 and just shows just the groove where he's leaving and, you know, the funk that we can know, heading into like proper disco, just dance floor, just I can't even tell it because it's just...
Well, it's from 88 then, so it's quite late on.
No words will... No words will describe how brilliant he is.
People get up, drive your funky soul. That's James Brown, the choice of Brona Gallagher, who actually performed in front of James Brown. No joke.
I kissed him on the lips, you know.
You kissed him on the lips?
I did kiss him on the lips, and I don't like to sort of sound like I'm dropping like a big kiss, but you know, it's been a few rocker snogs in my day. But I did kiss him because I walked up to him and I says, "You're the king." I said, "James, you're the king. Welcome back out of prison." Couldn't believe that coming to my mouth, but did. And I knew that he didn't understand a word that was coming out of my munchkin leprechaun dairy face. But I was like, "You're the king. And I love you. And my mum loves you. My dad loves you." And he just grabbed me by the face and he goes, "I love you, kid. You're beautiful." Yeah. Grabbed me and smacked a big kiss on my lips. And I remember being just covered in sweat and thinking, oh.
Cold sweat.
Exactly what I thought. And I wouldn't wash my fist for about 2 days. Yeah, man.
Ah, oh, Brona.
One of the guys that conquered. Yeah, JB. Yeah.
I tell you this much, though. I bet you didn't kiss Marvin Gaye.
Oh.
But you would have.
Marvin Gaye. War is not the answer. Only love can conquer hate. He wrote that line.
I know. Brona's just pointing out there that just a little hand clap at the end, just a little touch.
Last day, Barth.
You know?
Oh, my goodness.
Let's get it on there, Marvin Gaye. That's an extraordinary song, though, isn't
Unbelievable.
It?
Unbelievable. I mean, that, you know, you think of, like, Let's Get It On, What's Going On, you know. Let's Get It On is one of the greatest albums, you know, and he's produced it and he's got the best band, the Motown, you know, hierarchy coming and playing with him and the great James Jamerson and all the fantastic musicians that they worked with in Motown. But, you know, to me, that is when you appall drugs and abuse and toxicity, when you see any human being, no matter who they are, well known or not, but when you see how it's destroyed people's lives. And Marvin Gaye, what a prophet, you know, what a prophet, and what a singer, what an arranger, what a front, oh, just what a dude, what a babe. Mm. Oh my God, incredible. But that, check out all the early Marvin Gaye, all the young, Tammy Terrell, Marvin Gaye, all the early Motown stuff, you know, the voice, just the voice, everything about him. Marvin Gaye, you know, legend, genius.
Now, we're still in the 70s for your next track.
I know, I live in the 70s, isn't it terrible?
Yeah, that's all right.
Listen to modern music, which I do, and I love all the great rap, I love great R&B, I love Dr. Dre. I think, you know, what they bring to modern records now is extraordinary, and they're all coming from all these records, you know, and the great disco, a lot of the sort of Philadelphia disco and stuff.
But they never, even much, you know, however much you get to love them or how much you play them, they never really replace in your emotional life the stuff from back then. Mm. You know, they don't, yep, just can't replace that.
Because they're not sung, and the greatest instrument of all is the human voice. The most undiscovered instrument of all is the human voice. So when you've got these guys that are writing these songs, producing these songs themselves, and then singing them, you know, that's soul. Isn't it? I mean, I'm giving you all I have.
And I'm not, like you, I'm not one of these people that, you know, only music made, you know, 30 years ago was any good. I don't believe that for a second. I'm always keeping up with what's new. But the point is, you know, the stuff that you heard as a teenager is the stuff that will always mean most to you, no matter what happens subsequently, you know.
Yeah. And to me, that's real music in a sense. And I think what's happened now with the music industry and modern music, and I'm not doubting for a second, you know, some of the young stars that you see coming up now are good singers and great musicians and stuff. But I do believe there was a blueprint, and I do believe it's been photocopied and taken off into the sky, and the mothership has taken it away and burned what they thought was the blueprint. You know, and I do think there's an awful lot of crap out there that just is regarded as a great, great music. And, you know, no doubt some of the people that you hear are talented, but you just think, nah. That's where it started.
Your next choice takes me back to what you were describing earlier, coming home from school and just could not wait to put this record on.
Yeah.
Couldn't wait.
Well, this band, my mum seen in the embassy in Derry, because they heard that there was a band coming from Dublin, and the lead singer played the bass, and they were called Thin Lizzy, and my mammy and all her friends were mods, and these guys were rockers. And who are these rockers coming to Derry? What do you mean he's from Dublin and he's called Phil? And what did this band? And my mammy said they stood at the front of the stage, and out they walked, the biggest beaut ever walked at Isle of Ireland, and Phil Lynott. And to me, you know, all the early obviously, but this Live and Dangerous to me, if you ever, I mean, I love Zeppelin, I'm a Zeppelin freak, but you couldn't not include Thin Lizzy, who are the greatest Irish band. I don't care who else wants to challenge me. I'll arm wrestle you now. Bring me a band better than Lizzy, and especially this album. It's just out of control.
Oh, that brings me back, Brona. Listen. Rosalie from Thin Lizzy from Live and Dangerous. Brona Gallagher with me in studio tonight, picking all the music. Before we play our last track, Brona, it's the show business question. What do you got coming up? What's next for you? What's next for you, Brona?
Next for me is I have just been doing a film with Armando Iannucci, which is The Private Life of David Copperfield, which is hilarious. And I play Mrs. Micawber with Peter Capaldi as Mr. Micawber.
I can just see the two of you going about that.
Just being on the ground laughing at them all. Hmm. So it was a lovely job, and we were filming that, and that should be out now, obviously, later in the year. And a great cast, Dev Patel's playing the older David Copperfield, and then we've got three or four young, absolutely gorgeous little boys playing the babies up to about 7 or 8 Copperfield. So we sort of adopt David Copperfield, and they've got Tilda Swinton, Hugh Laurie, Ben Whishaw, Paul Whitehouse.
That's a hell of a cast, isn't it?
Great cast, really great. And Armando at the helm, being fantastic and totally crazy, but a wonderful director. So I was doing that, and then I've been involved in a new Sky show called Brassic, which is for Sky later in the year as well, which has been written by Danny Brocklehurst and Joe Gilgun from This Is England, the lovely actor that was one of the lead skinheads, played opposite Vicky McClure. So he's written that about his life growing up in Greater Manchester. So I'm playing quite an interesting lady in that. Let's just put it like that. I won't break the seal. But very funny script. And now I am recording new music. So I'm sort of halfway through my fourth album. So I'm just sitting in that moment of like, now what am I writing about again? So kind of collecting ideas, and I'm learning to drive. So watch out,
it's
Dublin.
Well, Brona, thanks a million for coming in.
Thank you.
You know, you obviously put a lot of work into that tonight, and
Absolute honour.
I appreciate it. Thanks, Brona.
Thanks for having me.
All the best to you. And your last choice is what? Alabama Shakes?
The one and only Alabama Shakes. I mean, Brittany, you know, Howard Demi is, to me, the third coming. She embodies everything that I love about soul and rock and roll, and she's just hardcore, and they're just a great band.
Brona, thanks.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast of Mystery Train with John Kelly. Mystery Train hits the rails every Sunday to Thursday at 7 p.m. on 96 to 99 RTE Lyric FM.